Well, thank you all for that very generous introduction, and my thanks to Elizabeth Weber also for having invited me for this occasion. I'm really honored to speak. Of course, the lecture series seems to me a wonderful occasion to bring forth some of my work on Benjamin. Benjamin's major writings only became available some two decades after his death in 1940. And by the 1970s, he had become one of the most widely discussed and cited of literary and philosophical thinkers. His work was cited on the par with Sartre, Foucault, and Heidegger. It was eagerly taken up by scholars and critics representing a wide diversity of positions, political, disciplinary, and conceptual. Some of his writings enjoyed instant canonization and were repeatedly cited, in some cases on very divergent ideological grounds. In this early reception of Benjamin's oeuvre, there was perhaps a sense of delayed justice, of rendering some kind of restitution to an individual who had been ignored and misunderstood and finally exiled in his lifetime. The forms of neglect and persecution that Benjamin suffered could not help but arouse a sympathetic response. Early in his career, he had been denied the opportunity to pursue an academic path by the rejection of his habilitation schrift at the University of Frankfurt, a work that has since been recognized as a profound and pioneering study in literary history. It's called The Origin of the German Mourning Play. Following this, Benjamin chose the career path of literary journalism, a field that certainly attracted some of the best minds in Germany of the Weimar period. One can think of Krakauer and of Bloch. His goal, he wrote to his friend Gershom Scholem in 1930, was to be considered the leading critic of German literature. Then the Nazi assumption of power in 1933 definitively blocked this path. Nonetheless, he produced a large enough body of literary criticism, for example, essays on Goethe's Die Wahlverwandtschaften, on Proust, on Baudelaire, Kafka, and Leskov, to secure his place as one of the major literary essayists of this century. At the same time, Benjamin's evolving materialist orientation, his interest in popular art forms, in the sociology of reception, in the historicity of the aesthetic, led him to an intense occupation with what may be termed the pragmatics of criticism. The work of Benjamin's last 12 years, roughly from the time he visited Moscow in 1926-27 to his death in 1940, may be viewed as an effort to come to terms with the inadequate idea of superstructure that he found in Marx's theory. Messianic ideas, deriving from his early speculations on language, are taken up again in the Marxist context, now directed to the formation of a type of writing that could intervene actively in the contemporary cultural and political crisis. Benjamin fled Germany in 1933 and spent the following 7 years in Paris, with brief stays in Denmark, where he was a guest of Bertolt Brecht, and in Capri, where he had stayed for extended periods earlier. His material circumstances were dire, and he was rescued from absolute penury only by a modest stipend from the Institute for Social Research, which had moved from Germany to New York in the mid-30s. When the roundup of immigrants, especially Jews, began in earnest in France in 1940, Benjamin attempted to flee to Spain across the French-Spanish border in the Pyrenees. When his first attempt to scale a pass, a mountain pass there, failed, he swallowed poison that he had kept in reserve and died in the border town of Poimboi. It is noteworthy that in the face of repeated setbacks brought about by professional and political circumstances, further of extreme material adversity during the period of his exile in the 30s, Benjamin did not waver in his researches and writing. He continued to work up to the very last, his flight from Paris, a few weeks before his suicide. Those years of exile yielded abundant and exceptionally innovative writing. If one considers the scope of his career from about 1916 to 1940, it appears as if every hindrance and blockage served as an impetus for an unforeseen yet fruitful reorientation of his thought. Benjamin's situation as a writer may be taken as paradigmatic at a number of levels. He aspired to a position both in the academy and in journalism. His writings have proved influential in fields as diverse as philosophy, Jewish theology, historiography, and literary criticism. He worked in genres that range from abstruse philosophical speculation to personal memoir and avant-garde experiments in a surrealist vein. His ambition as a thinker moved from what may be termed pure theory to politically oriented intervention. A few words about Benjamin's Judaism. His link to Judaism is generally acknowledged as a fundamental element of his work, but it is by no means clear how to engage this issue. Judaism cannot be assigned a consistent or unitary sense in the context of modern European intellectual history. The young Benjamin, in 1912, wrote to a friend, "The Jewish side, das Jüdische, goes without saying." This friend had challenged him to define his Jewish side, and that's what Benjamin replied. But this kind of retort on his part is more evasive than defining. He was later to be challenged in a comparable manner by Gershom Scholem, and though a tactic of evasion on Benjamin's part remains, the issue of just what constitutes the Jewish side takes on ever greater urgency and complexity in the later years. In the case of Benjamin, other factors complicate this picture. One of which, of course, is the role that his friend Scholem played, both as a kind of alter ego for Benjamin's religious consciousness during the latter's lifetime and as a custodian of his reputation afterward. Scholem was 17 and Benjamin 23 when they met in 1915. They maintained close personal contact until 1923 when Scholem emigrated to Palestine. Their friendship, however, continued up to Benjamin's death, largely through the medium of correspondence, and a correspondence which may be ranked among one of the major intellectual dialogues of this century. Scholem came from the same milieu as his friend, that of a prosperous, bourgeois, highly assimilated household. He demonstrated his independence of mind from the start, that is, Scholem did, first by rejecting the assimilationist culture of his family, and then at the end of the high school period, by refusing to follow his fellow Jung Yuda members into a more nationalist and politically oriented Zionism. Instead, he pursued studies in Hebrew and Talmud, without, however, being motivated to turn to Orthodox observance. In Palestine, as soon as he joined the faculty of the newly formed Hebrew University and eventually pioneered a new type of research of Jewish theological and especially mystical traditions, this approach, virtually created by Scholem, applies the methods of modern objective scholarship to writings which had been treated by observant Jews as holy and esoteric. Yet, Scholem's motivation was far removed from an Enlightenment impulse of exposure and rationalist simplification. He was strongly conscious of contributing to the recovery and preservation of an endangered cultural remnant. His writings on Messianism, which are gathered in a book, The Messianic Idea in Judaism and Other Essays on Jewish Spirituality, represents one of his major scholarly accomplishments. But it is noteworthy that many of these writings came after Benjamin's death. A detailed account of the relation of the two still remains to be written, particularly in its early phase, a decisive period in the intellectual development of each. Certain features of Benjamin's essay of 1916, which is called On Language Itself and On the Language of Man. This text has remained seminal for his thinking throughout his life, for Benjamin's thinking. And as I said, certain features of this text seem to derive from Jewish mystical sources, and one might surmise that they come by way of Scholem, who was then studying precisely this material. But an influence in the other direction is no less plausible. In view of Benjamin's familiarity with German mystical tradition, extending from Jakob Böhme to Franz von Baader, and also Franz Josef Molitor's Philosophie der Geschichte oder über das Judentum, a mid-19th century Christian compilation on Kabbalah. In a diary that Scholem maintained in that period, He quotes Benjamin as saying in 1916, "If I will one day have a philosophy of my own, it will somehow be a philosophy of Judaism." In the course of the 1920s, Sholem repeatedly invited Benjamin to visit him and later to settle in Palestine. Benjamin was receptive to the idea, but then invariably pulled back. It is in the light of this background that we can appreciate Benjamin's response to Sholem in 1930, when Sholem, not for the first time, raised the question of Benjamin's adherence to Judaism. In an earlier letter, Sholem had cautiously asked Benjamin whether it would not be better, quote, "to abandon false illusions regarding a never-to-be-realized definitive stand on Judaism, which we have considered a joint undertaking for nearly 15 years, and acknowledge the, however disappointing for me, but nonetheless unequivocal, reality of your existence outside that sphere," outside the Jewish sphere. And Benjamin, in his reply, while still delaying a full explanation on his stand on the matter, writes, quote, "I've never encountered the living spirit of Judaism, lebendiges Judentum, in any other figure than yourself. The question of how I stand in regard to Judaism is always the question of how I am related. I don't want to say to you, since my friendship in this regard is no longer subject to any decision, but to the forces which you have awakened in me." While such a passage suggests that Benjamin's Jewish consciousness was strongly marked by his friendship with Sholem, we cannot assume that he followed Sholem on central tenets of Judaism and notably of Messianism. Now I'll turn to the topic itself and begin with a very early essay of Benjamin. In 1914-15, as the war was beginning, he wrote an essay called "The Life of the Students." He was in his early 20s then and studying at the Berlin University and one of the leaders of the student body association. It's worth noting that Benjamin avoided later this kind of quasi-political involvement almost completely. This piece is an impassioned yet closely argued plea to his fellow students not to squander their time in frivolous sociality, but rather to focus on ideals of self-development, both spiritual and erotic. What interests us particularly in this essay is the way that Benjamin, just over 20 years old, outlines a conception of history that will remain with him to his last writings. I quote the opening of that essay. "The following remarks delineate a particular condition in which history appears to be concentrated in a single focal point, like those that have traditionally been found in the utopian images of the philosophers. The elements of the ultimate condition do not manifest themselves as formless progressive tendencies, but are deeply rooted in every present in the form of the most endangered, exodiated, and ridiculous ideas and products of the creative mind. The historical task is to disclose this imminent state of perfection and make it absolute, to make it visible and dominant in the present. This condition cannot be captured in terms of the pragmatic description of details, such as the history of institutions, customs, and so on. In fact, it eludes them. Rather, the task is to grasp its metaphysical structure, as with the messianic domain or the idea of the French Revolution." It is worth taking the trouble to describe the contemporary significance of students and the university, of the form of their present existence, only if they can be understood as a metaphor, as an image of the highest metaphysical state of history. End of quote. The idea that the metaphysical structure of history may be exemplified by either the messianic domain or the idea of the French Revolution states in its baldest form the alternative that then came to dominate interpretations of Benjamin's position up until quite recently. Today, we no longer find it necessary to deal with the issue in terms of such a polar opposition, messianism or revolution, theology or politics. We are more attentive to the way that Benjamin himself avoided a clear choice by means of parabolic or paradoxical formulations. For example, there's the fable at the beginning of On the Philosophy of History, those theses that constitute something like a philosophical testament written during the last year of his life, 1939-40. There he throws out a fable which deals with a chess-playing automaton identified as historical materialism, but hidden inside is a hunchback dwarf who represents theology. The allegory that Benjamin draws from this is that the apparatus, quote, can easily be a match for anyone if it enlists the services of theology, which today, as we know, is small and ugly and has to be kept out of sight, end of quote. Or, to give another instance of Benjamin's paradoxical pronouncements on his religious stance, there's the entry in the Arcades Project, "My thinking is related to theology as a blotting pad is related to ink. It is saturated with it. Were one to go by the blotter, however, nothing of what is written would remain." In other words, theology is omnipresent but invisible, like that dwarf in the automaton machine. We do possess other texts than the life of students from this early period of Benjamin's career that are highly relevant to our topic. Notably, a letter to Martin Buber in June 1916, in which Benjamin responds to Buber's invitation to participate in the periodical that he, Buber, was editing, Der Jude, the Jew. Then there's the essay I already mentioned, On Language as Such and on the Language of Man, 1916. Then another essay on the Program of the Coming Philosophy, 1918. And finally, a fragment written sometime around 1920-21 called, by Adorno, Theological Political Fragment. In each of these, Benjamin develops his highly personal fusion of philosophical and theological speculations that develop themes which will continue to preoccupy him to the last. And while these texts do not contradict the statement that Scholem attributed to him in 1916, you remember when he said, if one day I have a philosophy of my own, it will somehow be a Jewish philosophy or a philosophy of Judaism, still, the position that these texts indicate cannot be easily assimilated to Jewish traditions. Let me turn for a moment to this text, the Theological Political Fragment. I will only very briefly characterize this extraordinary but dense and suggestive document, which is only a single page long. It begins as follows, and I quote, "Only the Messiah himself completes all historical happening, vollendet alles historisches Geschehen." This is perfectly consistent with a traditional theological conception that one can find in Kant or Hermann Cohen, where the kingdom of God is the fulfillment of history. But then the sentence continues, "In the sense that he alone, the Messiah alone, redeems, completes, creates its relation to the messianic." End of quote. Now this second part of the sentence constitutes a radical break with a theological and progressivist conception. Werner Hamacher has given, I think, a convincing interpretation, and he writes, among other things, "If the assertion that only the Messiah himself will complete all historical happenings holds, then the consequence must be that there can be no teleological orientation of history toward the Messiah or to any messianic end." End of quote. The continuation of the text leaves no doubt that Benjamin intends an absolute disjunction between worldly telos and divine eschaton, between the course of history and the kingdom of God. I quote from Benjamin's text, "Therefore, the kingdom of God is not the telos of the historical dynamic. It cannot be established as a goal. From the standpoint of history, it is not a goal, but a terminus, an ende." What is more, in what follows, Benjamin links happiness, glück, with transience and the secular order. He links these three, happiness, transience, and the secular order, in a manner that remains constant throughout his life. The idea of happiness, and the German Glück doesn't quite correspond, but we have to let it do. The idea that happiness that Benjamin puts forward here has to be understood not as a supplement, an added positivity to existence, but rather as a wholehearted acceptance of one's earthly lot. For, he writes, I quote, "In happiness, all that is earthly seeks its downfall, and only in happiness is its downfall destined to find it. This idea, difficult idea, may be glossed by a passage in One Way Street, a later text, where Benjamin writes, "To be happy is to be able to become aware of oneself without fright." That is to say, to be happy, glücklich sein, heißt ohne Schrecken seiner selbst inne werden können, which means in a sense to be happy is to be able to become aware of oneself or to embrace oneself without fright. Again, as Hamacher has aptly put it, this text would more properly be called a political atheological text rather than a political theological one, since Benjamin is determined here to counter the theological residue of Kant's notion of freedom and of Hermann Cohen's conception of history. In Benjamin's last major piece of writing on the concept of history, and actually you have this in your handout, this quotation that I'm interested in, which is number one. This is taken from one of the theses, the second one of the group of entries in On the Concept of History. In this text, Benjamin again seeks to link happiness, transience, and historical temporality. Here, the idea of transience is figured as memory in the sense of Eingedenken, remembrance. And this sense of personal memory is projected onto historical temporality. I'll give you a minute, perhaps, to look at this very interesting entry. Let's perhaps read it through quickly. "It is one of the most noteworthy peculiarities of the human heart," writes Lotze, "that so much selfishness in individuals coexists with the general lack of envy which every present day feels toward its future. This observation indicates that the image of happiness we cherish is thoroughly colored by the time to which the course of our own existence has assigned us. There is happiness, such as could arouse envy in us, only in the air we have breathed among the people we could have talked to, women who could have given themselves to us." In other words, the idea of happiness is indissolubly bound up with the idea of redemption. The same applies to the idea of the past, which is the concern of history. The past carries with it a secret index by which it is referred to redemption. Doesn't the breath of air that pervaded earlier days caress us as well? In the voices we hear, isn't there an echo of now silent ones? Don't the women we court have sisters they no longer recognize? If so, then there is a secret agreement between past generations and the present one. Then our coming was expected on earth. Then, like every generation that preceded us, we have been endowed with a weak messianic power, a power on which the past has a claim. Such a claim cannot be settled cheaply. The historical materialist is aware of this. So as I said, in this text, the idea of transience, figured as memory, is connected with the sense of personal memory and is projected onto a historical temporality. The individual's acceptance of his destiny is a recognition of the secret index whereby the past is referred to redemption, that is, to its destined futurity. The sense that our coming was expected on earth reiterates the idea expressed in the theological political fragment. And again, it has to be understood in the sense of being able to embrace what one is, seine selbst inne werden zu können. And then the text concludes, such a claim cannot be settled cheaply. I want now to trace in a series of evolving stages what may be termed a messianic current in Benjamin's work. As we recall, in the passage cited from The Life of Students, he speaks of the utopian images of philosophers deeply rooted in every present in the form of the most endangered, exoriated, and ridiculed ideas and products of the creative mind. Now, it's in that sense that I want first to look briefly at certain types of narratives that Benjamin was strongly interested in, fantastic narratives, first of all, and then parables. So let's turn first to the what I call the fantastic utopists. He was strongly attracted to certain utopian fantasists, Charles Fourier, Fourier's phalansteries represent a kind of systematic application of the idea of passage. Then there's Sherbart, there's Blanqui, and the caricaturist Grandville. These are figures that someone like Adorno couldn't take seriously, but Benjamin did, though not for obvious reasons. I think he was drawn to such utopists not because they envisaged what would or should happen in an ideal society, but rather how one might imagine another social order, whether realizable or not. The section on Fourier, Charles Fourier, and on Grandville in Benjamin's text, Paris, Capital of the 19th Century, which is a kind of condensed expose of the Arcades Project, as I say, the section on these two figures is written in a manner that leaves in doubt whether Benjamin considered them unwitting heralds of the commodity system or veritable utopian fantasists. Thus he writes about Grandville, and you see one of Grandville's most famous illustrations here before you. He writes, the enthronement of commodity with its glitter of distractions is the secret theme of Grandville's art. Whence the split between its utopian and cynical elements, the subtle artifice with which it represents inanimate objects corresponds to what Marx calls the theological niceties of the commodity. This is, of course, the this picture is from the from An Autre Monde, one of Grandville's best series. Grandville was doing this in the mid-19th century, and this image is called Planète, Les Mystères de l'Infini, it's the Saturn ring. But as you see, the figure on the bridge there is peacefully smoking his pipe, taking a pleasant evening stroll from one planet to another. The next two images will be more relevant to what I've just talked about, that is, the way that Grandville represents a kind of forerunner, both representing and, of course, offering a critique of the commodity system and of the advertising system that is to follow. So the Saturn ring, which you see here, gave rise to an extended commentary by Benjamin in which he talked about the slow adoption of iron construction in the 19th century. Let's have the second slide too. Okay. This is more characteristic of what Benjamin talked about when he called Grandville's illustrations the Sibylline books of advertising. And he commented further, Grandville's masking of nature with the fashions of mid-century, nature understood as the cosmos, as well as the world of animals and plants, lets history in the guise of fashion emerge from out of the eternal cycle of nature. And let's have the third one too. Okay, this is a dream that Grandville, actually one of his last drawings, and he it's quite a remarkable figure, and I don't have time to go into it. And in fact, the connections between Benjamin's ideas and Grandville have not really yet been explored in any great detail, but it's something that intuitively I feel is very strong, and of course Benjamin did too. He didn't develop a long, detailed interpretation of Grandville, but he mentions him quite frequently and with great attachment. Let me turn to the next of these writers of the fantastic, and this is Paul Sherbart, who who's more contemporary, that is, he died in 1915, Sherbart was especially drawn to the novel of the Benjamin was especially drawn to a novel by Sherbart, a novel of the fantastic called Les Abendio. Let's have the next image, which is the title page of Les Abendio, published in 1913. A work which today might be classified as a children's science fiction. The name, by the way, is the name of the main character, and in the world of this particular asteroid, each individual is given the name of the first sound that he utters. So you have a great many rather wonderful Babel and childhood-inspired names. Benjamin wrote a short and penetrating review of this book in 1918. The work deals with an asteroid and its native inhabitants, tiny creatures not at all resembling humans, but endowed with a pure selfless sociability and an advanced, evolving technical capacity that reaches its maximal development in the figure of after whom the work is named. Let's have the next one. And that is Les Abendio, the hero of the novel. And these are illustrations, of course, are by Kubin, Alfred Kubin's drawings, which are quite remarkable and can be found in this edition, which is very hard to come by, in fact, and has not been, it has been reprinted in a pocketbook edition, but the original edition is still the most noteworthy one. Now, this Les Abendio is a kind of, what shall I say, a kind of leader, a fantastic leader who has an image, who has a dream of transforming his little asteroid. And he initiates and then supervises the construction of a tower on this little planet, a vast project, but one which, in contrast to the biblical Tower of Babel, has a wholly spiritual and altruistic goal. Let's have the next one then. And now we have a series of illustrations which deal with the construction of this tower. As it reaches its culminating point, this tower will eventually dissolve the architect's body and fuse his being, that is that of Les Abendio, together with that of his compatriots, and indeed the very star which they inhabit will somehow melt into a vaster ring of asteroids circling the sun. Let's go on with the next one. And these are various stages in the construction of the tower. And then one more. And then the last one, which illustrates, in a sense, the moment when Les Abendio's body takes on a kind of elongated form and flies up. And in the process, the asteroid itself somehow dissolves and joins other stars to create a ring around the sun. I can't go into the details of this novel, which is fairly long and quite detailed, in which Sherbart really imagines, in the best fashion of science fiction, all the work and technology that's required, I mean fantastic technology that's required to bring about the fable that he has in mind. What Benjamin admired in this work is a conception laid out with humor and modesty of a civilization whose inhabitants are totally absorbed in the maintenance and improvement of their material environment, but in a context in which technical labor is innately also spiritual. The great discovery of Sherbart, Benjamin wrote, was to direct a plea in the cause of creation from the stars to mankind. Continue his quotation. The gentle, amazed serenity with which the author describes the strange natural laws of other worlds, the vast cosmic projects that are undertaken there, and the nobly naive discussions of the inhabitants show him to be one of those humorists, like Lichtenberg or Jean-Paul, who seem never to forget that the Earth is also a star. End of quote. Some 2 years later, during his 2-month visit to Moscow in 1926-27, Benjamin, in an interview which he gave to a German on the German cultural situation, cited Sherbart's novel as the outstanding literary achievement of Germany at that time. And in the Moscow Diary, he noted, quote, "No other author than Sherbart has been able to demonstrate the revolutionary character of technical work." End of quote. In fact, Sherbart's novel was to be featured in an essay on which Benjamin was at work in 1921 called The True Politician, the Wahre Politiker, but for which the materials and notes have been lost. Still, we have many traces in his letters and other writings of his preoccupation in this period with issues of politics and class struggle. And of course, the theological political fragment, generally dated around 1920-21, supports this. But perhaps the most telling evidence for Benjamin's conception of a technologically based utopist politics is found in the last entry of One Way Street to the Planetarium, which was written between 1923-26, although only published in 28. There we read, and I quote, "This immense wooing of the cosmos was enacted for the first time on a planetary scale, that is, in the spirit of technology." And he's, of course, referring here to the technological forces that were released by World War I. Then he goes on. "But because of the lust for profit of the ruling class, because the lust for profit sought satisfaction through it, technology betrayed man and turned the bridal bed into a bloodbath. Men, as a species, completed the development thousands of years ago, but mankind, Menschheit, as a species, is just beginning his. In technology, a physis is being organized through which mankind's contact with the cosmos takes on a new and different form from that which it had in nations and families. In the nights of annihilation of the last war, the First World War, of course, the frame of mankind was shaken by a feeling that resembled the bliss of the epileptic, and the revolts that followed it were the first attempt of mankind to bring the new body under its control." Strange comment about the situation in Germany in early 1920s. I want now to shift to from these fantastic utopic writers to another kind of messianic narrative, what may be termed the Haggadic, the parabolic dimension of the Jewish tradition. Haggadah in Jewish tradition is typically linked with halakha, doctrine or law. And in the Orthodox tradition, of course, it's halakha, the law that has precedence. In Benjamin's Kafka essay of 1934, the relation of Kafka's parables to doctrine is similar, and he writes himself, I quote, "is similar to that of Haggadah to Halakha, whereby Benjamin takes Haggadah, that is the parables, as being variants of specific doctrines or teachings." And then he continues, "Kafka's are in fact not parables in that the doctrine which they interpret does not exist." Later, in 1938, when he sends a draft of a new Kafka essay to his friend Scholem, he reverts to the relationship of the two modes and now provides a more nuanced discussion. "The relationship of Haggadah and Halakha," he writes, "involves," I quote, "a sickening of tradition." And as he develops this, the sickening is something like a mutation conveyed through a variant of the idea of tradition as tradierbarkeit, that is, transmissibility. In the German, it's a little clearer when you move from tradition to tradierbarkeit. Both of them, of course, based on the Latin trado traditio, to give over, to surrender, or to pass on. Benjamin writes, "Kafka's genius lay in the fact that he tried something altogether new. He gave up on truth so that he could hold on to its transmissibility, its Haggadic element. To sacrifice truth, then, in order to hold on to its transmissibility, its Haggadic element, is to postulate a different kind of truth, one no longer embodied in the monumental form of tradition, but subject to the variability of transmission, which is precisely the Haggadic element. In this later formulation, Benjamin argues, Kafka's achievement is so noteworthy that the very relation of Halakha and Haggadah is transformed. In the earlier formulation, Kafka's instances were not parables. In the later, they are more than parables. Benjamin goes on. They are more than parables. They don't simply lie down at the feet of the doctrine the way Haggadah lies down at the feet of Halakha. Having crouched down, they unexpectedly cuff doctrine with a mighty paw. End of quote. I see I'm getting a little bit late in the hour, so I will skip a couple of pages and let me move to a discussion of the rhetoric of the theses of on the concept of history, which I've already mentioned. This text, a short text of about 15 pages, is reputed to be the last major piece of writing that Benjamin did before his flight out of France in 1940, his attempted flight out of France. And it is a text that repeatedly characterizes in a variety of formulations a messianic conception of history. And in the handout you have number 3, I've kind of picked out a series of quotations all drawn from these theses on the concept of history that in one way or another refer to the issue of messianism. The various types of figuration in these passages, which might be called dialectical images in Benjamin's sense, would each merit a detailed explication. But let me try to summarize their import. First, there is a sense of a momentary radical contraction of time made manifest in a flash of light or an explosive force. This violent intervention comes at a moment of danger, and that is a force that must be recognized and acknowledged immediately or else lost forever. This description, however, is focused on the content of the images and does not account for the rhetorical or discursive status of these texts, that is, the intended effect which is embedded in them as enunciations. Benjamin prepared on the concept of history a series of 18 short texts as a theoretical program for his Baudelaire book, which he hoped to draw out of his larger Arcades project. The significance for him is made clear in a letter that he wrote to Gödel Adorno in April 1940. I quote, "The war and the constellation that it brought with it have led me to put down a certain number of thoughts, which, I may say, I have sheltered these 20 years, yes, sheltered even from myself." He called this text on the concept of history, but referred to them often in letters as theses, a term which suggests a kind of performative valence. While the form of address is not explicitly illocutionary, that is, the addressee is not called upon to take action or even to adopt a specific belief, the arguments expounded are presented in an authoritative and apodictic manner. This is achieved in part through the personification of a figure called the historical materialist or historical materialism, an agent midway between addressor and addressee. One may identify this figure in the first instance with the speaker, as in the conclusion of number 2, which is the one that we've already read, where the addressor assumes a self-confident stance. Such a claim, that is to be endowed with a weak messianic power, cannot be settled cheaply. The historical materialist is well aware of this. But elsewhere, the figure can also be understood as a model to be assumed by the reader or addressee. This last point is supported by the way the addressor is frequently incorporated in the first person plural, we, our, us, as in this passage in number 2. Don't the women we court have sisters they no longer recognize? If so, then there's a secret agreement between past generations and our own, and so on. Here, too, the way that the text brings together a universal temporality with a highly subjective evocation is meant to appeal to the reader's most personal feelings. Let me conclude with a discussion of the issue of historical temporality in the Arcades Project, because of course some of these ideas, that is, for example, then our coming was expected on earth and so on, raise a great many philosophical and theoretical questions at the level of historiography. In Convolute N, which is more or less the theoretical justification of the Arcades Project, Benjamin gathered some of the major premises for his project. Here we find numerous formulations that read like variants of the theses, but the term messianism is much less prominent than in the latter. Here Benjamin is preoccupied with what you might call a retrograde temporality, a theory of counter-history that serves as the basis for those lightning outbreaks that the theses characterize as messianic. N3-1, which is a way of numbering the entries in the Arcades Project, which I've reproduced for you on the handout. N3-1 is the most trenchant and elaborated statement of the argument. I won't read it, but just briefly summarize. The preeminent terminological markers here are linked in a continuous series. First, time is a function of realized legibility, that is, to become legible, zu Lesbarkeit kommen. Then, the now, the Jetztzeit, the now time, as a particular recognizability. Then, truth charged to the bursting point with time, and thus altogether devoid of intentio, that is, of a causal chain of human projection. So it's devoid of human intention. Then the image, Bild, is a constellated fusion of present and past, crystallized as dialectics at a standstill. And finally, the dialectical image, dialektisches Bild, as imprint of the perilous critical moment. Let me try to summarize quickly. Messianism for Benjamin was in no sense the expectation of an ultimate redemption, but rather a willingness to confront the extremes, the extreme alternatives posed by the present situation. He had characterized his own thinking repeatedly in terms of the phenomenon of extremity, as for example in the letter to Gretel Adorno when he wrote in 1934, "You, first of all, will not be unaware that my life as well as my thinking has moved in extreme positions. The breadth that it thus claims, the freedom to move things and ideas which are considered irreconcilable in proximity to each other, gains its counterbalance, gains its countenance only from this danger." His view that the European situation had reached a stage of catastrophe, dass es nicht mehr so weitergehen kann, that things cannot go on like this, was already evident in the sketches and aphorisms that he had been writing in the 20s and which were then published in One Way Street in 1928. There he wrote, and I quote, "People in the national communities of Central Europe live like the inhabitants of an encircled town whose provisions and gunpowder are running out and for whom deliverance is, by human reasoning, scarcely to be expected. But the silent, invisible power that Central Europe feels opposing it does not negotiate. Nothing, therefore, remains but to direct the gaze in perpetual expectation of the final onslaught, on nothing except the extraordinary event in which alone salvation now lies. But this necessary state of intense and uncomplaining attention could, because we are in mysterious contact with the powers besieging us, really call forth a miracle. Conversely, the assumption that things cannot go on like this will one day confront the fact that for the suffering of individuals, as of communities, there is only one limit beyond which things cannot go on, annihilation." This was written in the mid-20s, in the wake of the chaos of hyperinflation and the social unrest of the period. In the following decade, In pursuing his preoccupation with the Arcades project, Benjamin did not lose his sense of the imminence of this danger. In spite of its preoccupation with the minutiae of 19th century social history, the Arcades project was to be a contribution to the philosophy of history rather than a work of documentation. And what is more, its aim, in the spirit of Marx, was not simply to describe the world, but to change it. Benjamin's writings in these years was directed to a collective subject, heirs of the Marxist proletariat, a collective not yet actual, still under the spell of the phantasmagoria of the 19th century. The goal of the Passagenwerk, the Arcades project, was to awaken such a subject, to further its emergence, its coming to consciousness as a collective. What Benjamin wanted to achieve in this work, he describes as follows. Comparable to the method of atomic fission is to liberate the stupendous forces of history, Geschichte, that are enclosed within the once upon a time of classical history writing, Historie. The kind of history that showed the object as it actually was represented the most potent narcotic of the century, of the previous century. End of quote. It is this dynamic potential of historical substance that Benjamin wanted to activate, and in explicating his historiography and his hermeneutics, that is his conception of meaning and of signs, we must keep in sight this underlying performative intention. At one level, the Arcades project is designed, or was designed, to be a work of demystification, a goal that Benjamin characterized on occasion in terms of a collective awakening. In selecting and organizing the materials for his work, Benjamin was on the lookout for data that bears the mark, that bears what he termed an alarm signal. What we construct here, he wrote, is a waker or an alarm bell, ein Wecker, that stirs up the kitsch of the last century into a collection. End of quote. But to make a category of reception constitutive for history writing involved no small dilemma. For how can such writing come about unless its addressee, the intended subject of the awakening, is somehow available, or at least conceivable as a projection? Benjamin here confronted a classic dilemma of Marxist theory, namely identifying in advance the collective subject of revolutionary action. He harbored no illusion concerning the capacity of the modern public to withstand the fascination and domination of forces that had appropriated the newer media technologies, whether at the level of the market or of the state. What Benjamin termed weak messianism in the theses is consistent with such a performative goal, a form of writing designed to awaken a readership by means of image, example, anecdote, and citation. He invoked at one point the theological notion of apokatastasis, which is the final restitution of eternal life for all those who have died, to suggest the recovery of a past, not in the sense of a transcendent eschatology, but rather as a practice of disinterment and extraction guided by a present need. His form of critique, of critical writing, was both diagnostic and enabling. The intent of the Arcades project, insofar as it can be deduced, was to realize a textual medium that would have the kind of capacity that Benjamin ascribed to fashion and to revolution, quote, a tiger's leap into the past. Thank you.